Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcasts for a free trial. And welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 172. This is Andrew Horowitz, and July is over already. And you know what we're going to do today? We're going to go back to school. One of the things we're going to be talking about is our Quanta Funda Tecna, you know, how we look at stocks and how we go through the screening and the fundamental and the technical side of things. And we're going to do that with your favorite, Kevin Hoffman, is going to be joining us today. But before we do that, we have a special guest from Briefing.com, Robert V. Green, who is he's one of the lead analysts there. He provides original technical research and analysis. And one of the things that caught my eye was a great piece that he wrote a couple weeks back on hedge funds and FinReg. And I want to talk about the impact of the financial reform and regulation bill that recently was signed and find out a little bit more about how this may affect not only hedge funds, but the entire financial aspect of companies, as well as what other things are in there. Because a lot of things inside of that are left open to further interpretation and later interpretation, as I think we all know. And there's a lot of things that are up in the air right now. So first, we're going to say hello to Robert V. Green. Hey, Robert, how are you?
Very good, thank you.
Hey, thanks for being here and talking about this, because I know there's a lot to do with this. We talked the other day, and you said that, and I gave my sympathies to the fact that you read all 800 pages of the latest release, right?
I have been through the whole bill.
Oh, man, that it must have been not only laborious, but is it tough reading, right?
It's tough reading. One of the problems is that at the last minute in the conference report between Christopher Dodd and Barney Frank, some of the best, most interesting parts of financial reform got dropped. Mm. And that was a great surprise to me. I was looking for the exact wording for certain things, such as right up until the last minute, the bill would have required daily reporting of short sales by everyone, including hedge funds, and that was a surprise because it wasn't offered in any amendment. It wasn't put forth as any of the problems in the bill. So why it got dropped at the very last minute, I can't offer an explanation for that. Perhaps the SEC complained we're going to be flooded.
Well, that I think it more so was the probable culprit was lobbying and the interests that were involved here. Because let's talk about what that is. You know, first of all, we're talking about a hedge fund regulation right now. That was what, Regulation SH, right? SH?
Well, Regulation SHO was a regulation to monitor and understand short selling done by the SEC, and you reported your short sales on a form called Form SH. Now, that experiment was suspended by the SEC last year, but the purpose of that was to really understand the role of the uptick rule. What the SEC is directed to do in the new financial reform bill is to conduct a study on the feasibility of having daily reporting of short sales by everyone, including hedge funds, and on the feasibility of identifying every trade by publicly as it occurs by its nature. Is this a buy to open a long position? Is this a buy to close a short position? Is this a sell to open a short position? That information is currently not available on the trading wire as it goes by on the ticket. And the SEC is going to, they've been directed by Congress to come up with a feasibility study of whether that's helpful or not. I can't see why it wouldn't be helpful, but they have to do a report.
That's the equivalent of what you have to do with options trading. Options trading, you have to say buy to open, you know, buy to close, sell to open, et cetera. That seems like that it would be an easy handoff to be in the stock market. But let's just back up for a second. You know, it's my understanding that this whole rule, this SHO and SH, the form SH, was to be used to, you know, really to cut down on the naked short selling that was going on and to identify maybe some of the larger holdings and to have greater transparency from the area of hedge funds in particular, who really do a lot of this work. And the new regulation would require 3 days. This is from your writing. The new regulation would require 3 days in where a hedge fund would, or a holder would have to expose their holdings inside of the short trading or the short term, the short position. But that, of course, would not include, for example, quick flips, you know, where someone would go out and short something and then maybe, you know, buy back the next day. But a holding would have to be exposed. Now, that would be of great interest, obviously, to a lot of people who track the holdings of hedge funds, because there's a lot of times that you find various different filings that come out throughout the day and the month, the year, that people are looking to, hey, you know, what is various, you know, hedge fund ABC or this particular, what are they holding? What are they buying? What did they raise their interest to 6% in this? You know, what is Carl Icahn buying in his hedge funds and all that? The problem is that now, which I think it would have been a great step towards further transparency, the hedge funds don't want it. Let's face the fact. They don't want people knowing what they're doing until after the fact, way after the fact. So, you know, do you take this as one more slap in the face of what financial reform was supposed to be into what it has become?
Just a watering down. I mean, hedge funds now have to register as investment advisors, which is a huge step. What it means is that the SEC now has the ability to discipline, if needed, if they break rules, to audit the books, to understand the position. I mean, hedge funds will now have to maintain a complete set of records and books that a SEC representative can come in and audit at any time. They will have to file holdings once a quarter, just like investment managers do now. You have to make a list of everything you own, and they will have to file what amounts to liquidity reports that shows that they're an ongoing concern, that they're strong financially. Now, that report doesn't really mean much, but it gives the door is open. Where I think it really fell down is in the short selling, because not all hedge funds have aggressive naked short selling strategies, but a lot do. And there are some studies that show that almost half of the daily trading volume comes from hedge fund computerized strategy programs that are trying to do arbitrage between individual stocks and futures contracts. And the nature of that trading and its impact on the market is in a dark, vague cloud right now. Right. We don't really understand what's going on there. So marking every single trade, regardless of who it's from, and having people report daily short sale positions, I thought those were really good things that would happen, and they vanished from the bill in the conference report 2 days before it was voted on.
You know, I got to tell you something, though. So much of the regulation, reform, and the intent, at least the words, are there, but just like with the healthcare reform, which was obviously also a vastly large scale, not only in size of 2,000 plus pages, but a large scale reform that really fell short on a lot of areas and also created further unknowns, not only for the marketplace, but from a cost aspect and from an actual legal standpoint. Like, what are the rules? I mean, I think there's still a lot of debate going on about the whole healthcare reform. Now, this financial reform, there are a lot of places, and talk about this a little bit, because aren't there a lot of areas that are left open to, okay, here's some idea, a vague idea of a rule, of a regulation that should be in place, but we're going to leave it as an open because we don't have it figured out yet. When it is figured out, it'll be placed in the bill or placed into law?
Well, what the bill does is create authority for some of these ideas to be implemented, but doesn't demand them. For example, the concept of self-regulatory organizations. The SEC was created in the Great Depression in order to regulate the financial industry, primarily the selling of stocks and bonds. But what they did is they created a self-regulating organization, which used to be called the National Association of Securities Dealers, NASD, and is now called FINRA. They changed their name, but it's a policing organization made up of members of the industry that it's regulating, a self-regulating organization. So the NASD used to police they still do as FINRA, the activities of stockbrokers, discipline them, fine them, examine their representations. You couldn't put out any advertising to the public unless it had been approved by the NASD. That's a self-regulating organization. And the SEC then interacts only with NASD. It
right.
doesn't have to deal with every individual broker and to police the industry.
But is there enough?
The bill allows the SEC to demand the hedge fund industry to create their own SRO.
Oh, good. Another, fox guarding the hen house, right?
It does, although I will say I think the NASD has done a pretty good job over the past 70 years. But it doesn't require the SEC. It basically passed the buck on whether hedge funds should be an SRO from Congress to the SEC. Is the SEC going to demand the hedge funds form their own self-regulating organization, just like the NASD covers broker-dealers? I don't know. I mean, it's
yeah,
now
I
in the
you.
SEC stance. But if they decide to do it, they have the authority in this bill.
So, backing up for a second, because there was a whole, you know, the big thing that everybody saw across the media was this whole idea that we'd have this financial reform bill, and it would stop the too big to fail. It would stop the whole potential for a cataclysmic financial Armageddon again, like we almost saw in 2008, and it would also give some further powers to different people and all that. But, you know, one piece at a time. Too big to fail. I don't, from what I can see, it doesn't have anything that remotely even resembles a stopping too big to fail.
Well, I think what it really did is make rules to cover situations they've already followed. In other words, if you go back and look at the actions of the federal government in handling it,
mm-hmm.
the government didn't provide TARP money for everybody. And frankly, we could talk for hours about TARP because the initial idea, I think, was good, and the way it was implemented did not follow that initial idea. Something that happens in government activities, government regulations, they evolve over time from their initial good idea. But the sweeping nature of this financial reform is just overwhelming. I mean, it covers insurance companies. It covers the daily procedure of how mortgages are going to be sold without talking about Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac in any way.
In any way. That's just amazing. How do they leave that out?
I think it's political. The Congress cannot criticize Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac
right.
because they've behaved by directives from Congress.
And primarily from the writers of this bill.
Well, Barney Frank has been a strong advocate of Fannie Mae as a promoter of housing in America. But to be fair, so of Republicans, it's hard to stand up and say, I don't want more capital allocated to the mortgage housing market before this crisis happened. Nobody, it was an unpopular view. But Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are not addressed at all in the financial reform bill. And the statement coming out of members like Barney Frank and others is that we're going to deal with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac later, meaning after the November elections. That's how I take later to mean. They're not going to.
Yeah, they don't want to have any of that blood on their hands right now, and they can't decide whether it is, in fact, an entity that is going to be continued with this idea that they are explicitly backed by the government, or if it's going to be just this kind of idea that, okay, well, it's this casual relationship, and somebody's saying, well, we wouldn't let them fail, of course, even though they're in a heap of trouble. And I think right now, if my recollection is correct, there is an unlimited amount of backstop that has been said and has been said a few times that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac get.
Well, there's an implied, any bond issued by Fannie Mae is guaranteed by the U.S. government. In other words, what the way it works, the benefit of U.S. government guarantee sort of ripples through Fannie Mae because they originally started, Fannie Mae would issue a bond, the payment of which is guaranteed by the U.S. government, just an ordinary bond, not backed by anything except the credit and faith of the U.S. Treasury. But they use that capital then to start buying mortgages and put them together in a pool and then resell that pool of mortgages, which technically does not have the backing of the U.S. Treasury, the full faith and credit and guarantee. Technically, that particular mortgage pool security is not backed by the U.S. Treasury.
Right.
However, because the capital that was used to buy those mortgages and create that is backed by the U.S. Treasury, the market viewed Fannie Mae bonds as the government's not going to let this thing fail, and that's turned out to be the case. It's really the motivation of, I think a lot of the motivation of the government's involvement came from the realization that if we don't save the housing industry, which was headed for dire collapse, we're not going to be able to provide the full faith and credit behind the original Fannie Mae bonds, which they equaled, you know, that's where they got their capital.
Right.
We're not going to be able to provide the full faith and credit. And then that ripples through to, hey, U.S. Treasury bonds, why should we believe the government's going to back those? I mean, once you lose confidence in currency, the whole thing goes down.
And that's exactly the point, isn't it, Robert? It's a confidence game. I mean, in the truest nature of all of it, it's a confidence game. Because you have to think about the average investor for a second listening to this. And just the discussion you just had about Fannie and Freddie and how not convoluted because of your doing, you explained it, but convoluted the whole relationship of the government is or isn't. I mean, it's got to be very confusing to the average investor.
It's a complicated world. There's no question about that. And when you get a mortgage to live in your home, whether you're an investor, sophisticated or not, you're part of that system because the housing, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were more than 50% of all mortgages in this country.
Right.
All the other people like Lehman Brothers, it was became such a good market that those people just entered the market and said, hey, there's money to be made here. Yep. Let's compete with the government
right.
in this. That's what really drew the housing market to its critical, overcapitalized state.
Right.
And it is very complicated. And frankly, you know, credit default swaps, which were really focused on in the beginning, you know, if you go back to the fall of 2008, everybody in the media was talking about credit default swaps. And they're intelligent, educated people in this industry. And I never heard anyone explain a credit default swap correctly.
Well,
I mean, I wrote pieces back then to try to explain them.
It's amazing. It's you know what? You think about credit default swaps, and the word that has to go on there is the word derivatives. And we all swore off derivatives from a market standpoint right back to the Enron days. Remember that? No more derivatives. Long-term capital management, no more derivatives. No computerized, automatic, algorithmic trading of sorts. You know, that's the whole downfall of long-term capital, wasn't it? It was that the Black-Scholes and their equations and their computer generated buy-sell signals, if you will, blew out. And you know, we think back to the flash crash. And then on top of it, you know that everybody said no more derivatives are going to be allowed after the Enron collapse. And what happened was for 5 minutes, you saw a bit of a, you know, okay, everybody was scared. You know, you got what do they say? God scared into them. There are no atheists in a foxhole. Everybody's like, okay, I believe. And then the craziest thing happened. Not only did we get derivatives, but we got more convoluted and much more dangerous derivatives that were regulated to a lesser extent of it was previously.
That's true. That's very true. It's almost like the alcoholic saying, okay, I'm not having any more wine, but what's this thing, a mojito?
Yeah.
Let me try that.
Exactly.
That sounds pretty
exactly.
interesting.
Exactly. It just doesn't end. You know, it's the very nature of our markets. Give me the top things that you could think of in the financial reform bill, and you know, just a couple of things that really stick out to you, aside from the hedge fund, regarding banks and financial institutions, regarding maybe prop trading or something that really sticks out as something that really we should be watching.
Well, actually, I think the biggest unknown is the creation of the Consumer Protection Board, because exactly what that entity is going to be and how they will function is very, very vaguely defined. It could be an organization as big as the SEC. It has the powers that are given to it in the bill are just as sweeping as the SEC. I mean, we could have the SEC is regulating Wall Street. We could have this Consumer Protection Board now regulating credit cards in the same way as individual brokers are regulated today. There's been some discussion, you know, the Consumer Protection Board is going to, you know, keep you from being deceived or swindled by a credit card company, a financing company, a mortgage loan or whatever. But it's an ongoing entity every day.
Right.
It's not going to, you know, sort of like, okay, we're going to clean it up and then we're going to leave. That organization is, I think, over time, going to become as important as the SEC, and nobody's really focused on the nature of that in your daily life.
Yep.
I think it's going to change all kinds of things. It's going to change how you do debit cards at the supermarket, and in what way, we don't know. So that's probably the single biggest thing.
There's been a lot of controversy as to how that affects some of the players in that industry. You know, we see almost every day that, you know, the Visa, MasterCard, which are the key players in the debit card area for fees, of course, there's going to be an issue where, consumers could have the choice of whether to pay cash or not. There was this kind of situation where some places would say, you know, under 10 were only taking cash, and it was illegal according to the Visa and MasterCard bylines and laws that, empowered the various gas station convenience stores or stores to take money. And that's changing. But the question is how much? And are they going to go to credit versus debit? And there's just, you know, back and forth of how much is going to affect them or not. Or is it going to be, as we probably would suspect, most of these laws, when it comes to increasing the fees to the various players, whether it's the bank, credit card company, mutual fund, hedge fund, or financial institution, in the end, who is it going to really cost? It's going to cost the consumer, the investor. It's all going to trickle down. It's just going to trickle down.
Well, that's true. I mean, regulatory costs do get borne eventually by the consumer of whatever service is being regulated. But the thing is, what you were mentioning, you know, a discount for cash versus credit is technically illegal. There's a federal law that says you cannot have a cash price and a credit price unless they're both the same. But who do you report that to? You know, I've been to restaurants that say, if you pay us in cash, we'll pay the sales tax.
Right.
Now, technically, that's a discount for cash, right?
Right, well...
They're getting around it that way. Who do you report that to if you're concerned as a consumer that you're paying too much with your credit card?
Right, well, it's the same thing. Or on the other hand, why not just get the cash deal? And the same thing with the nanny tax. You know, who's going to report if they have a nanny that they should be paying tax on the deal? I mean, you know certain things you want to keep quiet. It's in your best interest.
But I think this Consumer Protection Board, they're going to be the people who are going to deal with those kind of things. So we're going to have that kind of police in the industry, which has never existed before. Now, you asked me what I think the biggest impact is. I think that's the biggest impact because it's the least well-defined and it's the most authorized. That can become as big as the SEC.
So tell me, in wrapping this all up, give me, very simply, in terms of bettering from what we had before, if you just take a black and white approach, you know, before FinReg and after FinReg, do we get a thumbs up to the outlook in terms of financial markets and to what this is going to do for the consumer, et cetera, and for the investor, or is it a big thumbs down?
It's so big that you have to do it by section, but I do think the regulation of hedge funds is the single biggest positive improvement of this bill. It doesn't go as far as I had hoped it would, or that it was going to go right up until the night before the vote, requiring short sale. I think that the nature of trading in the markets is going to be very different a year from now than it is now. It's going to be remarkably different. Exactly how, I'm not sure. But having hedge funds step into the light and having to report positions, it's going to be a remarkable change. It's going to be the biggest.
Well, how about this?
I make
this invitation. 1 year from now, we'll get back together and we'll see how much has changed. My bet is nothing changes.
Okay. I think daily volatility is going to change quite a bit.
That would be interesting. I hope so. That would be an interesting thing because the daily volatility is out of control. You know, 2%.
It's out of control. And 2% I think this is an attempt to bring it into control. If they forced them to make daily short sales, I think, would really come into control. But they're going to do a study on that, which maybe just buys them. Maybe that was a last-minute attempt to buy some time.
I hear you. Robert V. Green from Briefing.com. We have a great relationship with Briefing.com. We get a lot of information and actually take some of their analysis and kind of pepper it through our analysis. And, of course, you have to check it out. Briefing.com is a great source. Really, seriously, I'm not kidding. A absolutely great – they have some free things there too, but a great source for market information, trading information, right-to-the-minute information on economics, stocks, et cetera, analysis, major, major place that you want to put on in terms of your trading day and investing outlook. So I thank you so much for joining us today, buddy.
Thank you.
Have a great
summer. Thank you. Always a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks, me too. All right, we're going to be right back. Back to school again. We're kind of getting back into that time. We're going to be back with Kevin Hoffman talking about Quanta Funda Tecna, talking about some screening things. We're going to give you some screens to actually look at and maybe see if there's something that you can do to brush up on your investment technique and all of this. We'll be right back. Thanks for joining me, the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hold on. We'll be there in a second. I thought that was a good conversation with Robert Green, Robert V. Green, as he likes to be called. And now, as I promised, we're going to talk a little bit about back to school. You know, when I think about back to school, you know, I was actually in Walmart the other day, and I couldn't believe it. You know, here we are in towards the end of July, and people are starting to buy those composition books. And I said, I can't believe it's back to school already. And they said, you know, it's not so close. It's getting there, but it's not so close. But you know what? It's like 25 cents if you buy them now. If you wait till when back to school and you get the supply list, you know you're going to have the composition books on there, right? And they go up to $1 a piece, and there's none in the store. So I figured, I guess that's a good idea. But anyway, I thought what we would do is kind of ratchet it back just for a second because a lot of things happening in the market. There's new rules, regulations, as we talked about. But what can we do to kind of restart and reinvigorate our engines, to get kind of on track when it comes to the markets right now? So I thought we'd do is bring back Kevin Hoffman. You know, he's my right, my left hand. If I had more hands, he'd be all of those too. Great analyst, really good manager of money. Works here at Horowitz Company, of course. You've heard him before. You've always enjoyed his discussion. And we're going to talk about Quanta Funda Tecna. We're going to talk about getting back to basics, and we're going to have hopefully an experiment in that we're going to try to push through the iTunes feed. We're going to push through the PDF of the information we're talking about. So I want you to do me a favor, test this out for us, see if that actually comes through. We're also going to put the information about the screen and the results and all the information in the show notes. of this particular episode over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. But tell me if it actually works, if you can see it on your iPhone or your computer, your iPad, on any device that you're using, if you actually get that PDF inside of the iTunes RSS feed. So let me know. Anyway, Kevin, how are you doing, buddy? Everything going well?
Yeah, things are great.
Well, thanks for joining us again. I mean, obviously, you're always busy toiling away, figuring out some great stock ideas. And I thought, wouldn't it be a great idea to have you back talking about how we can generate some things, maybe out of the box, how we actually look at things. But I thought what we'd do is, you know, tell me a little bit and kind of go to people listening. You know, we favor this whole process versus just shoot from the hip. But, you know, we favor this process of looking at stocks and ETFs and investments in a way that we can actually go through and identify things unemotionally. I want you to go through just very quickly that process, that three-prong process.
Right. So the important thing to remember here is that you want to keep everything as simple as possible and keep it into your range of understanding. So when we start and we start looking at individual securities, we have to first narrow down our list of stocks because right. When you're looking at the total world of stocks, there's just way too many to even fathom or to even to comprehend as to break down to analyze them. So what we need to do is we need to develop some kind of a screen or some kind of a filter. Imagine it like taking some dirty, dirty water and breaking it down into something that's very clean and crisp and pure. So now what we're going to do is with these screens is we're going to filter out via market cap or via price to earnings or some kind of other technical indicator to get something that's more simplistic and less amount of securities
right.
So that we can analyze them in a more efficient manner.
So the thing is that what's interesting is that you mentioned, first of all, that there's so many different stocks to choose from. What do you choose from? But I think the opposite is true a lot of times with people. And what they do is they'll look at, for example, stocks only that they know. You know, they're going to pick up like a Starbucks or an Apple or a, you know, something that they've had experience with. You know, they wear Nikes or Crocs or something like that, and they you know, buy that, you know, those stocks because they know about it. But here's the thing: how many people really know what a Millicom is or American Mobile is or possibly even a Patriot Coal? You know, if you don't know about that, whether they're good investments or bad investments right now, I guess the point is that not only are we trying, I guess, filter, but it's also expand the opportunity to find things that may not have been thought about before, right?
That's right. There's just so many stocks out there in the investment universe, and you may not have heard some of those stocks that Andrew had mentioned, but you would never know that some of these particular securities have done so well over time. And if you wouldn't have seen them, you would have never known about these particular opportunities.
So all right, so we go through this process. Now, let me just mention something that we utilize several different sources of information. It's garbage in, garbage out, right? Wouldn't you agree with that, Kevin?
That's true. Very true.
So, you know, you're going to set up the screen, and what you're going to do is you're going to look for different criteria, different things to look at. But the problem is if you don't do it properly and you don't pay attention to it, you're going to get some real information that may not be suitable. So it's always a good idea to make sure that your screens are, first of all, from a source that the information that's being represented, that's being showed in the results, if you will, is scrubbed and it's good. We use Bloomberg. You're not going to probably buy a Bloomberg out there if you're just listening and you're a casual investor. Let's put it this way. I could buy probably four cars, one Lamborghini for the price we pay of a Bloomberg subscription on a monthly basis. But there is good. There are a few good places. I think, what do you do? You did FinViz, right?
Yeah, I think right now FinViz is probably the most robust screen that we've seen so far that's free, per se.
Right, right.
I know MSN used to have a great screen, but unfortunately, I believe they took it down.
In the infinite wisdom of the Microsoft team, the best product they ever had available, the screener, and the portfolio has been discontinued.
That's right.
Thank you, folks. Google has one too. Yahoo has a screener also. But again, I agree with you. It's not as robust, and I don't think it shows you the data. The data from, where's it from? Thomson Reuters, right?
I believe so. Yeah.
I mean, that's you're either going to go with a Bloomberg or a Thomson Reuters, and while I would think that the Bloomberg has a lot more data points that we can choose from, as well as, you know, the data that you choose. It's kind of like vanilla chocolate, the scrub data from Thomson Reuters or the scrub data from Bloomberg. I mean, it's just, you know, a preference, and they're both good. So I know that we talked about this last week, and we talked about what can we do to kind of show a screen that may have some potential idea generators in there. And right now this whole market has been based upon this gigantic move up, kind of a whoosh up or a whoosh down. And one of the things that really was interesting to us was this short interest. You know, kind of explain what the, you know, go through that, what our thinking was on that.
Well, the thinking is if we get a huge market rally, or if we get a lot of strength within the whole broad-based market, we're looking at the fact that if we have some security that has a high short interest, we may start to see some short covering, which would be
like a squeeze.
Yeah, very much like a squeeze, and it would really bring the stock up by a great percent.
Right.
So when we looked through this screen via FinViz, we looked for some of the highest short interest stocks that are out there.
Right.
So
Let me say something. You know, not often people think that. I think it's really important to recognize that, you know, when I think of high short interest, a lot of times I'm thinking, well, a lot of people are betting against the stock. So why in the world would I want to buy that?
Well, the thing is, it's mostly just for a trade. It's not necessarily something that you may want to hold for a long period of time, because you're right. If there's a high short interest, you really don't want to go against the crowd.
I mean,
if everybody is discounting that this stock is not a good security, it's more than likely it's not a good security.
Right.
But if, however, you get this this phenomenon with the whole broad-based market moving up, then you could get this possible short squeeze, which would really drive the market up, where all these short sellers are really nervous about the fact that the stock may get away from them, and they drive the stock up. It's not actually people necessarily wanting to buy the stock or wanting the stock, but it's short sellers that are panicking to sell or to cover their position.
And the big boys who know the stocks that have the big short interest, especially the ones that have low volume and are more thinly traded potentially, they'll go after those, right?
That's right.
I mean, that's what we see. I mean, it's like shooting fish in a barrel.
That's right. They'll push it up and
They'll break your legs on the way up and then take you right down, so you're going to be miserable both sides.
That's right.
Yeah, and that's a problem right now with this market where we're seeing such a heavy I think you and I talked about this too, Kevin, that we see, you know, we watch the desk color on a daily basis. Desk color is various places like a Goldman or a JP or a Merrill. You know, what are their trading desks doing? And we're finding that a lot of the work on a daily basis, this high volatility moves, have been primarily due to E-minis and future trades.
Right.
So, you know, there's no buyers that are stepping in. There's not a lot of short sellers that are taking positions, but it's the short sellers covering, because they're running for cover after they put on a trade for 2 days and the thing is just busted. Or on the other hand, it's just the E-minis. That's why I see everything going up, or down at the same time. It's like kind of all, you know, a tide raises all ships either way. So, all right. So we did this. You looked for short interest. Now, let me also state for everybody, I'm going to ask Kevin a question. He's going to answer the question. You're not going to probably catch all of it, because we're going to rattle through all the different screening criteria, but that is going to be available in this PDF so you can replicate it yourself, right? Didn't we have that in there, right?
That's right, yep.
All right, so what other criteria did you use to kind of create this screen of stocks that may be interesting to take a look at?
So when I create a screen, I typically go from some of the most basic information all the way to the most detailed information. And when you start basic, it helps you narrow down the security. So, you know, if you start with somewhere around, I don't know, anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 different securities, you want to start narrowing it down as much as possible. So I started off first by just narrowing down the market capitalization. The market capitalization is just basically how big the company is.
Right. Shares multiplied by the current price. Shares outstanding multiplied by the current price. Number one stock out there right now is ExxonMobil. Number two is Apple. Number three is Microsoft. And you just have to think about that to see how amazing that piece of information is, if you think about Apple.
Right. So at first we did a market cap of greater than 300 million, which would basically be at the very low end of some of the small caps,
right,
all the way up to your greatest big cap companies like the ExxonMobil.
Right.
And then after that, we looked at an average volume of 500,000. Now, we talked about previously about liquidity, but for this particular purpose, we're looking for something that we have the ability to trade and to get in and out of in a liquid and efficient manner.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have something that trades more than, for us particularly, 500,000 is basically our minimum. But for an individual retail investor, you could probably, you know, anywhere from 100,000 to 200,000, I would feel comfortable with.
Yeah, but still don't you worry about the fact that they're trading smaller lots. But don't you still worry about their ability to get out if something goes wrong?
That's true. Yeah, that is. I mean, that is a good point.
I mean, I think that for this screen, if we're looking at shorts and short interest covering and the potential for a short squeeze here, that we'd want lower volume. I think on the lower side of the volume, but not so low that it would make somebody really, have a problem if they're trying to get out. Although, again, if we're looking for a short squeeze, that's exactly what you want.
That's right.
You know, if you're looking to squeeze and you're looking to make somebody, you know, and just think about that. We're looking to squeeze them, make them sweat, panic, and run out at any price. If you're going to buy that stock and that happens, well, then you want to have lower volume so that a lot more people are running for the exit real quickly.
Right. But once again, 500,000 trading a day is really, in the grand scheme of things, not that much in today's market.
Right.
So after that, we screened for price. We wanted securities that were greater than $5, and that's just there's no real rule about that, and there's no real truth to it. But you know, we kind of wanted something that was more robust in price.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you may lose some securities like a Citigroup or something like that that's now trading below $5. But you know, we figured some of the more high quality or quality stocks, things that are worth looking at, are greater than $5.
Okay. Not a steadfast rule, but
right.
To take a
just
look
a general.
Yep, yep.
Next thing we're looking at is the float short.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the float short isn't exactly a short interest or a short interest ratio, which you may want to look at, but unfortunately, FinViz doesn't have this ability. Now, we have this ability in our Bloomberg screens, and that's just because they have almost an infinite amount of tools available.
Right. Plus, you could do your own calculations and create your own.
Right. It's literally infinite.
So, but let's stop on that because I think it's important. So right there, there's an interesting point there. I think an interesting lesson. Does that mean that the individual investor that's not ponying up to get the kind of systems that you may have as a professional is somewhat handicapped in this circumstance? I mean, I know this is one area that maybe you would have preferred to have something versus the other, and you made up for it in some of the other parts of the screen, but is this something that you want to think about? Because if you don't have the ability to do all the different screening criteria, does that give you doesn't give you the advantage that you'd want? I don't know.
I don't think it's necessarily an advantage or a disadvantage. I think it's just how you use the tools to come up with the screens you want. It's just
so it's not the size of the tools; it's how you use it.
That's right.
Uh-huh,
right.
Uh-huh.
It's the building blocks.
All right, I got you. All right,
I mean, you really need these. It's better than going out there and just picking some random securities.
Right,
you have to start somewhere, and you have to use the tools available to you.
All right, so again, I think personally, the most important part of all this is that you have clean data.
Right.
You have scrub data that's clean, meaning that you don't have any straight. Oh, we've actually noticed a variety of different earnings numbers. We saw a 90% drop in earnings on one of our Bloomberg reports recently, and we said, wait a minute, that doesn't seem right. Something's definitely wrong with that. And we actually found that there was a slight error in the decimal placing, right?
That's right. Yeah.
But here's the deal. If this is what you and I talk about all the time, and we bang our heads against the desk about, if we didn't find that data, that may have been excluded from a screen that we look for from an earnings growth standpoint.
That's very true.
So, you got to be really careful with the data that you use, and it's hard to really manage that process. But anyway, it is. Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's all right. Well, there's just so many, so much data out there. It's impossible to almost get it, be accurate at all times.
Right.
So.
So how many did you get out of all this? I mean, there's so many different screens you can work with. We talk about the this one is like a high short interest screen where you have the ability to look for high short interest and then to look at, what may be debt ratios and all that. And then, again, we're going to have all this on the site for you to look at and hopefully in the podcast feed. Somebody write to Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com to tell me if you got it or you didn't get it, the PDF in your iTunes feed. But there's also things like Dogs of the Dow. That's a quantitative screen. There's high dividend yielders, the highest dividend yielders. There's GARP, growth at a reasonable price. So we have this now. How many actual names did you get out of the screen? What did you narrow it down to?
So the number of securities that we have is like somewhere between like 10 and 15. But the really cool thing about some of these screens is that you can change your numbers on the fly and get as many or as little securities as you want. So you can kind of tweak the numbers, whether it be changing your market cap to 500 million versus 300 million, or changing
and that's more important. That's better than changing some of the core numbers like the short interest ratios.
Right, right. Exactly. Yeah. Or you can change your EPS growth from 10% to 20%. You'll get a smaller amount of securities when you do those sorts of things. so you can just narrow it down to as best as you would like.
All right, so after we do this, we got a number of securities, and then you narrow it down by doing some fundamental analysis. Let's kind of go through that whole process. Which one? You have a stock? Did you pick one particular one?
Yeah, so from our screens, we looked at a couple of the securities that we were pretty familiar with, and one of them we actually have in some of our portfolios.
Uh-huh.
The first one we looked at was Lululemon, and if you actually if you download this PDF report, or if you actually complete this particular screen on FinViz yourself, you'll see this particular security on there. And so one of the things is, when we go through fundamentals, we want to look for things like price to earnings, price to book. We're looking for EPS growth rates. We're looking for revenue growth. You know, really we're looking for strong companies that are built to increase over time. You mm-hmm. know, we're looking for somebody as strong who's going to lead the pack, take the charge and go for it.
So, but again, that's not this particular screen.
No, you're right. That's not this.
That's what we try to build, right?
Right, right. That's not this particular screen, but you know, even if you have the high short interest screen, you still want a company with somewhat decent fundamentals. You know, you'd like to pick the best of the bunch,
right.
Per se.
Yeah, obviously.
Right. So, but this is just kind of an in general talk too, as well as far as looking for fundamentals. But you're looking for strong companies, whether it be if you're looking for a particular dividend, you can look for a particular dividend yield. Looking for either low or high beta, just depending on where you want to go, and that's basically it. I mean,
so we're looking at, and one of the things you have is the most recent report that we prepared for the stock on Lululemon. We have about a 6.5, a strong buy on it because we do a composite between our technical score and our fundamental score, and we're looking at things like the 50-day moving averages on technical side, 50-day moving average, the volume pressure, which is a little bit light on this actually. I'm surprised about that. It was a little bit. Under one. I thought it'd be a little bit more than that right now.
It's actually a good thing compared to what it's been doing lately.
Right.
Lulu's kind of come down a little bit off of its highs.
Right.
And having that volume pressure be low like that might actually be a good thing.
That's a good point, because it's over a period of time. And then as it was trending down lower, that's a good point that you make there. Long-term debt is zero. Return on equity is unbelievable, 30. Forward peg is only 1.16, and that's good. That's on estimates, and that's pretty accurate right there. EPS growth quarter over quarter is 107%. You wouldn't think this at a higher-end retail chain, but Lulu is one of the top in terms of floor profits per square foot, if you will. And also, they haven't even really expanded yet. They're just primarily in Canada. That's a whole different discussion. They're probably in Canada, some in the United States, some overseas. I think one or two stores in Australia. They haven't really saturated the market. They do some online too, but really haven't saturated the market. And you got to wonder, is this a love affair that is going to be long lasting in terms of the yoga and athletic gear, like a an Under Armour that really became very much part of the process of people's lives in terms of wearing it regularly, or is this going to be just staying inside of the area of just maybe some people that do yoga and all that? I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, this is a very niche company. It has a lot of athletic gear,
right.
And it's more luxury goods.
It's higher priced.
It's expensive.
Yeah,
it's,
it is.
It's not something reasonable. It's not something you go and buy 10 shirts from. you go there and you get yourself one pair of yoga pants and one one yoga shirt.
Exactly.
Definitely not a Sports Authority. That's for sure.
I'm not going to be using it for yoga. I'll tell you what. I tried it one time. I tried yoga one time. It was fascinating. First of all, it was much harder than I ever thought it would be. Right. But I was sitting in some kind of a position.
You
and
did
I
the
was,
hot yoga, right?
I don't know what I was doing, but I was twisting around a bit. And they said, Andrew, we want you to turn your body. We want you to really turn your torso around. I said, I feel like my front is now behind me. I feel like I'm so turned around. They said, you're not even moving. You're staring straight. I said, I am so twisted around. I'm going to make a 180-degree turn any second. They said, you need a little bit more practice. That's hard stuff, that yoga. That really is. Did you ever do yoga?
I've done yoga quite a bit, actually.
Really?
Yeah, the Bikram, the hot yoga, where
really?
You sit in the 105 or 110 degree room whatever, and just sweat.
Oh, great! So we're going to put this on the list, Lululemon, and again, from a technical standpoint, actually, it has a breakout candidate here. Technical score is not as high as we want it to be, but it's really rising very dramatically. Technically, it's actually a good point here. So Lululemon's interesting, and because the short interest is a little bit high, it's also an interesting candidate. The other, what do you have next? What do you have? You have athletic, and then you have diet. Is that how this works?
That's right. We're on a a back to school type diet.
Yeah, huh? Start the new year off, huh?
That's right. That's
so, what do you got? You got Nutrisystem?
Yep. So Nutrisystem is the next security we took a look at, mm-hmm. and it's one of those companies that's, you know, it's diets. It's they're selling their food, they're selling their consulting, they're selling their product, basically.
Right.
And as far as fundamentals go, this company has done really well. Its mm-hmm. EPS growth has been unbelievable. Over the past 5 years, it's been up 81%.
So why is there so much short interest on this?
Nutrisystems is one of those companies that has always been plagued with the thought of fraud on their books.
Mm-hmm.
And
really?
I believe so.
Well,
yes.
I know Medifast was like that.
Well, I think they're very similar companies in the same space. So,
well, I mean, I guess it's also the whim of people if they're going to go out and spend money on diets, and you know, if they're going to go through that. I mean, there's a lot of players in this space also. But Nutrisystems, and then you have to buy their food, and then you know how many people really stay, and the churn rate with them. But you know, the thing that I notice here on the particular report that we did here, this is what we call our one sheet, is that you only give it a 2.1 rating, and its fundamental score is okay. Its technical score is lousy.
Right. Yeah, the technical not looking very good right now. You know, it's below both the proprietary trender that we use, and on the fundamental side, the earnings per share growth has been declining rapidly. You know, it's only from the looking forward that they're looking for EPS to increase. And if you look at the PDF download, you'll see some bar charts, and the blue bars are the ones that are actual reported earnings, and then the red lines are the expectations.
That's on the second page of each report.
Right, and the expectations are what the analysts are actually looking for in the coming quarters or coming years. And on Nutrisystems, it's a very cyclical company, as you can imagine. You know, you get this huge influx of people during January coming in to say, wow, I'm looking to diet, I have this New Year's resolution, I need to get thin. But
who does that?
I'm not sure.
I always tell people my favorite time of the year, not now, but January, February, is when you pass by the fitness clubs, and like on January 2nd, you can't even get in there with all the cars.
That's right.
And then like by February 1st or 2nd, there's like no cars in the parking lot. That's the cyclical nature of this too. It's the same thing. So you got the kind of the new year. What do you got? I would assume that you have back to school is kind of a time period that right. may be in that. You got the new year.
Right.
And you probably got pre-summer.
That's right.
You know, so those are the three times. And anybody else, by the way, you're licensed to get fat as you want after that, okay? That's what that is, I guess. No, but Nutrisystem has a much lower score. But is this still, I mean, how do you stack those up? Again, we're talking about trading opportunities here utilizing this. I mean, does Nutrisystem look like a better short candidate?
A better short candidate or
a better long candidate?
Yeah. Yes. Yep. It actually may be a much better long candidate for a short squeeze. And that's because this company is not highly regarded and not highly followed as much as like a Lululemon is. Lulu is a much more fundamentally sound company, whereas you can see by Nutrisystem, the fundamentals are good, but the technicals are awful at this point in time. You know, but if you get a breakout, there's some good levels here that if you start to see a little bit of a run-up on Nutrisystem, you're going to get a short squeeze. So that would be something I'd keep on my radar over the next few weeks or so, and see if we can get above some of these levels. There's a top end of this this particular security, and if we can get above that, you know, it could be
because it's been in a consolidation phase for a while now. And the other thing is that you do see some volatility, but there's the average daily volume is somewhere in the 200,000s or something like that. Is that what's on here? Actually, your volume pressure is 1.26 on this,
right?
Which is interesting, but the daily volume on this is much lower than a Lulu. So
right.
It's in the 200 plus or minus. Actually, what do you have? You have 500. Was that 30 days? So that's a 30 days average volume.
Yep.
So all right, two different things. So we went through the screening process. Now we got the fundamental process and the technical. Now we give a technical score here, so we can take a look at that. That's our quick glance at things. We look at trending. Directional
stochastics, yep. Moving averages, looking at volume pressure, looking at the different particular trenders that we use, the moving average, convergence, divergence, all the different.
And then to pick out time, that's the whole point. You know, let me explain something here. I think after the end of the day, when you think about everything, it's not really so much as the stock or ETF or investment you pick. it's kind of like the stock or investment you pick, but when you pick it also. Now, I'm not trying to preach market timing per se here, but if you pick it at the wrong time, you may lose money. You pick it at the right time, you make money. So it may be the same exact security, same exact process, same exact quanta fund attack, and the fundamentals, all that. But if you pick it at the wrong time, it's a problem. So, you know, when we're looking at breakouts, when you're looking at breakouts over prior resistance points and volume points and where the volume has been, volume pressure, you know, both of these look like good opportunities. We're not recommending these per se. We're just taking you through this exercise. I mean, I think we both agree to that, right?
That's right. Yeah, we're actually not very impressed with some of the results from the screen, to be honest. But, you know, it's just an exercise in, you know, how you can use these screens and what the process is in order to develop a screen and analyze these particular securities.
Right. I mean, it's important to have some kind of a system down of some sort. I don't think there's such a thing as a turnkey. I talk about this in my book. By the way, this whole process is outlined in The Disciplined Investor. You can grab that over at Amazon. It's on Kindle. It's available for also Audible download if you can stand to listen to my voice for a few more minutes. This whole process is outlined and gives you very good examples of how to use it and some good head starts on screening techniques and actual examples. Also provides you the whole technical, whether it's a head and shoulders pattern, whether it's consolidation congestion, whether it's uptrend, downtrend, moving averages, all that's in there, very easy to understand. So if you want to pick one of those up, it's pretty cheap over at the Amazon, et cetera, or Audible, or on iTunes. You can grab the book as well. It's like, I think, $7 for the audio book. That comes with a download, by the way, that gives you all the pictures you need. But the thing is that there is no system. And I talk about that in the book about how, you know, there's this fictitious company that uses different colors of whether you should buy or sell or what you should do. There is no easy answer like that. All this takes hard work.
That's right. It takes time, and you just kind of have to see the different patterns and understand the different technicals and fundamentals and put it all together.
It's a puzzle.
That's right. One thing to note, though, while we're talking about technicals, is that on FinViz, you actually can search for these particular different patterns. You know, if you're looking for a particular head and shoulders pattern, or if you're looking for different trend line supports or resistance, if you're looking for channels, both up and down, you know, all these different patterns that are, you know, I guess your typical technical patterns, those are available to screen for on FinViz.
Right. So with that, we're going to kind of end this back to school special. We talked about, of course, in the beginning with Robert Green from Briefing.com, all about what's happening with FinReg and what's not happening, probably more importantly, with FinReg with regard to the hedge funds and all the things related to what's going to happen in potentially for credit card companies and for us, the consumer, who will probably be paying most of the load for all of this. And we have a somewhat of a bet, if you remember. One year from now, we're going to come back, and he believes there's going to be a big change in the trading patterns of hedge funds 1 year later. And I said, hogwash, there'll be no change. They'll get around it some way and figure out a way to just do what they do as all times. So I bet you that most of you are thinking the same thing, if I know all the people that listen and write to me. And then, Kevin, we're going to kind of put all this on the website on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We'll put it under the show notes for this particular episode, episode number 172. And we'll also put it in a feed, and we don't know if it's going to work or not. If you're listening to this and you have no idea, just go back and look at your playlist over on your device, whatever you're listening to this to. And if you do it through iTunes, you're going to see a feed link right there. And maybe through other devices, you see it too. So somebody who's listening on an Android, if you're using that for your podcatcher and you're getting your feeds that way, please tell me what's going on that way. Somebody that's on an iTunes, an iPod, an iPhone, please write me as well. And if you're just using a computer, I'd like to know if it works too. It's an experiment. We'll see if we can actually pass the information down through the system. And just send an email to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And Kevin, we'll finish it up that if people are listening to us and they like what you're talking about here in terms of that, I mean, I guess they probably hit that 14-minute video.
That's true, yeah.
You know, that explains a lot more about how we do what we do. That will be on the site. Just click the thing that says, hey, virtual tour, 14 minutes, and check it out. And that's kind of how we use the process to identify individual stocks, much different than what we do for our global allocations, which are primarily ETF-based, which we'll talk about at a different time. But for now, Kevin, thanks so much for, you know, coming along and coming a few offices down to the studio here at Horowitz Company.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks. Listen, we'll talk to you soon. And thanks for joining us on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We'll see you real soon. If you have any questions, you know where to find us. Be safe. Invest wisely. Make some money. Get some profit going. Talk to you soon. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.